Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with sociocultural anthropologist Jessica Winiger about contemporary art in Egypt, and Eleanor Bravo will join us from Food and Water Watch. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program author Sally Bingham. Her new book is called Mending. It's a collection of new and selected short stories, and she will be reading tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So this is new and selected stories, and we're going back to the 60s.
We're going back to the 50s.
To the 50s.
The first story that I ever published is in this collection. It's called Winter Term, and I wrote it junior year in college, and it caused a terrific commotion. Hard to believe now, but people thought it was a very shocking story then.
What was shocking to them? It's almost hard to understand those sensibilities.
Well, they claimed they were shocked because it did reveal that this Harvard and Radcliffe undergraduates were getting into some kind of mischief together in the back of a car. Of course, we all knew that was going on. That wasn't any real shock. I think the shock is always when something is put into words that people all know about, but they don't want it put into words.
So was that the beginning of your aspiration as a writer?
Yes, though it frightened me. When you're that young and people are telling you you've done something terrible, it's frightening. But it also revealed to me, which was much more important, the power of the written word. And that was inspiring to me because, like all writers starting out, I hadn't realized that my words had very much power.
So where did you go from there? You kept writing through college and after college.
Yes, and because of that story, which won an award, I was noticed by an editor at Houghton Mifflin in Boston, and she asked me if I was going to write a novel, familiar question for short story writers, and I said I was. And by the time I had graduated, I had written a novel, which fortunately is long lost and forgotten. And she said,
as most first novels
exactly,
are and should be.
Exactly. And so, as she said, this is, you know, good for your writing, but it's not good for publishing. And so I wrote another novel the year after college, and she published that.
This is something that I've always wondered. There are some people who seem to be real short story writers. That is their medium. And it's not just a warm-up for the novel.
No.
And for others, it is.
Yeah, I am, I think, at root a short story writer, although I've written 5 novels, so I haven't limited myself, if you call it a limitation, to short stories. I do think that there's something about my sensibility that seems to work very well with a 15 to 20 page short story, because I write with a lot of intensity, and I write from very quirky and very startling points of view. And with a novel, I know from the novels I've written, it all tends to be a little more plot-oriented and to depend on a character that maybe is not quite that surprising, because it's difficult to maintain a surprising point of view for 350 pages without totally alienating your reader.
In a short story, you do need some kind of plot, but you don't need the same kind of development that you do and subplots and so on that you have in a novel.
Yes, and I've never been that interested in plot, although, as you say, plot is essential. One of my stories, Selling the Farm, in this collection, the plot is that these two sisters have inherited the farm they grew up on and they have to decide what to do with it. So in the course of 20 pages, the decision is taken with its consequences.
Right.
And I find more and more as I write short stories that I'm more interested in plot. I'm not as interested in the powerful, mood-driven short story that I started out writing, although I like those still, but I'm much more interested in the way character is revealed through the development of plot.
Interesting. So would you say, because it's something I wanted to ask you about, I mean, you had to select stories that range a half a century.
Yes.
When you were reading through much more material than is in this book, Did you, and it may be hard to reflect on one's own writing in that way because you're so close to it, but could you see how your writing has evolved?
Oh, yes. Now, I didn't choose. My editor chose. I sent her about 40 unpublished short stories, and she had my earlier three collections to go through. I didn't feel I had enough objectivity to choose. And I found that I agreed with her probably 95% of the time. There was one story she wanted to include that I didn't want to include, called The Old Woman, that was a very bitter, sarcastic story, and we agreed to drop it. There was one new story I wanted her to include called Exchange, which she did not include because she felt it was too ambiguous. So it was as though the two ends of the spectrum got knocked off, which is probably wise for balance.
We're talking to Sally Bingham. Now, looking through the dates on your stories, you have stuff from the, well, according to the table of contents, the 60s and 70s,
right.
Although the first one is from the 1950s.
Yeah.
And then you go into the new millennium. There's a big gap. Were you not writing novels in that middle period?
I was writing novels.
I mean, short stories?
I was writing novels, and I was also writing plays.
Uh-huh.
That was the period when it began to be really hard to publish short stories. Publishers had made this draconian decision that nobody wants to read short stories. So I realized as a working writer that I had to change the medium. I needed to go into a new field. So I wrote, I think, six plays. Four of them were produced in that period, and wrote three novels and a memoir. So I was moving steadily along, but I had, unfortunately, from my point of view, had to abandon short stories because I didn't think I could publish them.
Well, they say that novels sell something like three or four times as well as short stories, but that doesn't mean that there's not this devoted universe of short story readers out there.
Absolutely, and it is a devoted universe. I find the people who start reading my short stories will read all four collections. Not necessarily true of novels. I think people may read one novel and like it enough, but not like it enough to buy three or four more novels by that writer. So I think it's a wonderful hidden compartment of literary life that we're probably not as aware of as we might be.
The book is called Mending, and the title story is a story about kind of a healing of a person, a young woman.
Right.
And it's the only one that isn't dated, and I wondered if you did that on purpose. I don't know if it's an early story or a late story.
It's actually an early story, and I think we didn't include the date because it was a mystery story. I had literally forgotten that I had written that story. And one day, I was cleaning out the garage, and I saw this old beat-up paperback anthology. And here was this story, among stories by many other writers, too. And so I'm not really sure when it was written. I know it was written a while ago, but because anthologies often cover a period of time, I'm not really absolutely certain when it was written. And it is a young writer's story, I feel. It's not a story that I would want to write now.
Right.
Because it's about that kind of confusion that young girls sometimes get into, particularly when they're very focused on relationships and the relationships haven't worked the way they thought they would or dreamed they would, and they have to find another way.
I think one of the delights of getting a little bit older is that you're not so focused, and especially as a female, focused and obsessed, for whatever cultural or biological reasons, on relationships.
Absolutely.
And that must give you some freedom in your writing as well.
It gives me enormous freedom. It's an opening out of the universe. I really don't think I will ever again write a short story that is focused exclusively on relationships because I just don't find them that interesting anymore. And it's in the new stories. There are five brand new stories in this collection. One is about a woman who takes in Haitian refugees. One is about two sisters selling the farm. There's one about a teenage girl who's lost in Paris and has to find her own way. So they're really spreading out in terms of the universe of the short story. It's a mistake to think that short stories are what they're sometimes called, little jewels. I think of them as big jewels with very sharp points.
The one about the girl in Paris who's lost and finding her way operates on multiple levels because, of course, we've all been both physically lost in a city where we didn't know where the bus went and mm-hmm. we don't speak the language and that kind of thing.
Yes.
But that's a metaphor for another kind of being lost.
Yes, and in her case, because she doesn't understand anything about the Cold War, and she's been plunged into Paris during the Cold War because her parents are stationed over there, she's also lost in the confusion that young people sometimes feel in this very complicated political situation that is not, in those days, was not being explained.
Right, for example, she doesn't know what the word commies
yes.
means, and then when they say it means communist, that didn't really help that much.
No, it didn't help because she still didn't know what it meant, and she tries to break it down into its syllables and figure out what each syllable means, and of course that doesn't help either.
So, one thing that I think, I don't know, I mean, we're talking about the evolution of your writing and how it's changed, but maybe one thing that has not changed is the process of getting into people's minds.
Yes.
And having these very subjective interior view of the world.
Yes.
And the feeling tone and the all the emotions that come along with being on, you know, inside your head and trying to negotiate whatever situation you're in.
Right, and I'm most interested in getting inside the heads of people that I would probably find quite unsympathetic. There's a story in this collection called Benjamin. It's told from the point of view of a 91-year-old painter who's a real horror, very successful, making his last trip to open a big exhibition in Los Angeles. And he's a really repellent character, which made him so interesting to write not about, but from the point of view of, because I could try to begin to feel what it's like to have that kind of arrogance. And I loved doing that, even though it was a little scary. I remember thinking, because it was as though he was telling me his story, I hope he's going to go away when I finish writing this.
What do you mean he was telling you his story? Like, did you feel that this character you created became a presence who was talking
yes,
to you?
Yes, he became a presence. It's the only time that's ever happened to me, so it's not a recipe for writing short stories. But he definitely was a presence. And he had this story that he felt should be told, that revealed his dreadful narcissism, his arrogance, but also revealed that he realizes he's about to die, and this is the end of the trip. So I needed him there. I don't think I could have written the story without Benjamin being there, but I also needed him to leave, and he did.
And he did. Well, that's good to know. When you write a story about an unsympathetic character, in this case, an arrogant character, I would think that, I mean, on some level, and I've thought about this a lot, fiction writers have to do some of the same things that actors have to do, which is that they have to kind of dip into that universal well of human experience.
Yes.
And even if this person doesn't have anything like their personality, they have to find that character in themselves.
Absolutely.
And so you as the writer have to find arrogance
in
yourself.
Oh, he's there. Some part of Benjamin is definitely in me. And it's why I love writing from the point of view of people that we would say are insane, because that's also a part of me. That story, I really adore this story. It's an old one called The Wedding. Is told from the point of view of a young man whose wife is literally insane, and he takes her to a big family wedding, and she does something terrible that is very embarrassing, and he has to hastily take her away. I love that because I think the point of view of the people we call insane is enormously rich and even, you could say, valuable.
I have to say, I had a friend who's no longer with us, who was put into a mental institution when he was younger, and he seemed pretty sane to me, but I don't know what he was going through then, but he came out and he said, when I look at what people are doing in society, they were saner inside that building.
Absolutely, and also often the people we call insane are just seeing too much, and we don't want to hear what it is that they're seeing. Because we all live with a certain level of hypocrisy and deception. We don't want somebody to peel those veils away.
We're talking to Sally Bingham about her new book, Mending, New and Selected Short Stories. So you have a lifetime of writing that you've been doing. Do you have a... I just have to ask you this for all the aspiring writers out there. Do you have a routine? Do you have a discipline?
Yes, I do. I've been very fortunate because I never had to work 9 to 5, and I really don't know how anyone can write who does have that kind of demand. I was able, from the very beginning, from when I was a teenager, to make the kind of decisions that I think you have to make, such as being able to get up really early in the morning. I'm often up at 4 a.m. and really find those first hours before there's any noise in the world, any vibrations coming through, and do my first drafts then. And I always write in fountain pen on paper.
Is that right?
Yes. The right hand is an important hand in creativity, and with the computer you're using both hands, which I think is quite different.
Very interesting.
And then I let it rest for a week, and then I go back and put it into the iMac. I think you have to be dedicated. It's very difficult for people in this world because we all have to make a living. We all have relationships and houses where we live or apartments we have to keep up, dogs to walk, the supermarket to go to. But if you're going to be a serious writer, that really has to be secondary. And when I meet women, particularly in the workshops that I give, who have always had the dream of being a writer, and maybe now they're middle-aged, it's never happened, and it isn't for lack of talent. It's because it was so difficult or even impossible to put that first. And so they've tried to write, for an hour here and there, and I just don't think you can do it that way.
Well, as a friend who's a writer here in town, who shall remain nameless, used to tell us, aspiring writers, she said, writing is like having an affair. You just find time for it.
That's a wonderful comparison, because we do find time for the affairs. That's absolutely true, and you have to make sacrifices. You're not going to be able to have the kind of social life you might like to have. You're not going to be able to go to as many movies or look as much television or spend as much time on Facebook, because all that is vital energy that you really need to preserve for the absolutely essential act of writing.
Sally Bingham, how have you seen the place of women in fiction writing and in publishing in general evolve over the time that you've been writing?
It's been very interesting because, to speak of publishing first, when I started out, I had friends who had graduated from college with me who went into publishing in New York and devoted their lives to it. But with maybe one exception, they never rose to the top level in the big publishing companies, even though they worked there for their entire working lives. The top level is still entirely men, as I say, with possibly one exception. Little bit different at the small press, like Sarah Band, my publisher. There's a woman who started that press and who runs it. But still, as with all corporate work, the top level is still the men. I think it's not going to change until a lot of other things change, having to do with things like the amount that women are paid compared to what men are paid, still hovering around 77 cents to the dollar.
Right.
All of this has a great deal of meaning. It's not just in a vacuum. As for women writers, women have always written a lot of fiction. The great 19th century writers are women. I think of George Eliot, the Brontes. So we have, I think, been able to find our audience as fiction writers. It's been much more difficult, I think, for women to write nonfiction, to write history and biography. We have gotten somewhat sidetracked on writing memoirs and autobiography. And because that tends to be the weakness of new writers, it's, I think, been a mistake. It's gained a huge audience. And it's somewhat twisted the notion of what women write back to the old idea that women can only write about themselves.
Right. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Sally Bingham is an author whose new book is called Mending, New and Selected Short Stories. She will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock. So we look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you. It's a privilege to have a chance to read here. I'm very excited about it.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Jessica Winiger. She is a sociocultural anthropologist, and she will be giving a talk called Creativity and Revolution, Egypt at a Crossroads, and that is at the New Mexico History Museum on Thursday, the 6th of October at 6:30 in the evening, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So you apparently often start your lectures asking people what comes to mind when they think of Egyptian art, and of course it's ancient Egyptian art and King Tut's tomb and so on. And I suspect that most people listening right now have no idea what contemporary Egyptian art is like. What's going on in Egypt? What is the art scene like? Are you looking at the big cities pretty much?
I'm looking at the big cities. It's an incredibly vibrant art scene. It has been in existence for over a century now, in fact. It's the largest art scene in the entire Arab world, the largest and the oldest. And it's become extremely vibrant in the past 10 or so years because there has been a lot of interest directed at the region, especially after 9/11 and the wars in the region. And so Egyptian artists have had a lot of opportunities to show their work abroad, and that has returned back home in terms of their resources and interest in creating all sorts of new art projects. I have to say, I used to start my talks asking people to imagine what comes to mind when they think of Egyptian art, and usually people think of King Tut, but now in light of the revolution, I'm wondering if people have a different, perhaps more contemporary image in mind of Egypt.
Well, what is the art like? What media are they working in, and how are they responding to current events?
Well, Egyptian artists work in all types of media, painting, sculpture, printmaking, new media, such as digital work, video art, performance art, installation. So it really runs the gamut. It can be figurative and representational. It can be abstract and conceptual. Photography is becoming quite popular in the region. Right now, many people in the art scene are just trying to figure out how they can do art in light of recent events. The biggest push has really been to bring art into the streets, to do a lot of art in public spaces. There's a big program called Fen El Miden, which is basically art in public squares in Tahrir and in other squares throughout the city of Cairo and throughout the country of Egypt. And the idea is to bring visual artists, musicians, theater professionals to the public and have the public interact with them. So it's really a kind of a revolutionary moment where there's this idea that we can get art out of the rarefied spaces of the galleries and museums and maybe use it for real social change and interact with people and find out what their vision is for the new Egypt.
To what extent are artists being censored or hassled or oppressed in any way by the government, if they are?
Do you mean right now or in the past?
Yeah.
Okay.
What?
Right now, well, this relates to another major trend in arts in the country right now, which is murals that are being done in public spaces. They're spontaneous murals done to commemorate the revolution, to commemorate the first victory, which was the ouster of Mubarak, as well as to call people's attention to remaining issues, which are really large, that need to be addressed. And there's a whole category of murals which are honoring the martyrs of the revolution. These are people who died in Tahrir Square and in other cities as a result of attacks by Mubarak's forces. They're called martyrs in Arabic. That's martyrs for the national cause or martyrs for the country. It's akin to our notion of a war hero. And there are many, many murals that have been done with pictures of these martyrs and on sayings commemorating them. There has been some controversy in that it's believed that the Ministry of the Interior, which has been the object of much criticism, erased a couple of the murals. painted over them. And so this ignited a fair controversy in the artist community that how can there be, you know, censorship of what we agree upon was, you know, is a you know, national hero or an art for a national cause. The artists went out and repainted the murals. So that's the one major incident. And I think it's because whoever painted over it probably wanted to, you know, deny the idea that people were killed at the hands of government forces. And that's the subject of the trials right now, trials of Mubarak and other ministers and people in the military.
Well, let's talk about Mubarak and how it was under Mubarak for artists. I mean, was there a lot of censorship at that time?
You know, there really wasn't. What's interesting, there wasn't of visual artists. There was much more censorship of writers, of literary artists, because their work was much more popular, was much more known, had greater, you know, visibility than visual artists. Visual arts is not the most popular of the arts in Egypt. That is, you know, arts that you would find in galleries and museums. And actually, under Mubarak, the Ministry of Culture really prided itself on having an open attitude towards the visual arts. But artists always spoke about internal self-censorship. They would say, you know, we don't do anything that talks about politics, religion, or sex. Those are the three forbidden topics, and because we're afraid that we will be censored. So it's a complicated issue. There was no real direct censorship, but there was a lot of self-censoring that went on.
If those subjects were excluded, what was left?
What was left was actually expressions of national pride was a huge theme in artwork, but there were also political critiques, but they didn't, they weren't as obvious, perhaps, to someone who's not familiar with the visual arts or familiar with how artists express themselves. There were a lot of, for example, there were artworks that criticized environmental degradation, artworks that criticized gender hierarchy, that criticized poverty in society. So nothing that was against Mubarak per se, or that called out regime figures, but criticism of the general decline that artists were feeling in Egyptian society.
We're talking to sociocultural anthropologist Jessica Winiger. Now, when you look at Egyptian art, contemporary Egyptian art, how does it relate to on the level of technique, medium, I mean, where they're coming from, to European art, to American art that's being created at the same time?
I would say that it is very similar to that art in that now in this more globalized arena with, you know, access to the internet and artists' access to funding opportunities abroad and travel abroad, there's a lot of interaction. So artists are using many of the same techniques, the same media, and have some of the same sort of conceptual approaches as artists in Europe or the United States. I would say that the main difference, though, is that they're really rooted in Egypt, and so they may be concerned with global issues, but they're looking at how those get articulated in the space of Egypt. Some artists may use materials that are specific to Egypt or are viewed to be specific to Egypt, such as red granite, which was a material that, you know, ancient Egyptians used to make their sculptures. Or another artist might use trash in her art that she collected from the streets of Egypt. And so this is, you know, an expression of, say, the problems with garbage collection in Egypt, the problems with excessive commodification. So it can really run the gamut. But if you went into an art gallery showing contemporary Egyptian art, you wouldn't say that it was inferior or really different in technique or style than art in the European American capitals. But you would definitely see a difference in terms of the interest of the artists and their rootedness in problems that they are facing, just like an artist from New York would be expressing issues that he or she, you know, experiences in their particular location.
Sometimes there are many critics of art scenes, whether it be in the U.S. or Europe, who talk about the disconnection between the art gallery and museum scene and what ordinary people are doing on the street. And as you said earlier, there are artists trying to bring art really to a more popular audience and mm-hmm. of more ordinary people. How are they doing that, and how effective is it?
Well, they're primarily doing it by having these art festivals in the squares, but also there have emerged in the past 10 years in Egypt, 10 to 12 years, some art organizations that are not necessarily located in the downtown area where the art galleries are located or the elite areas, that are located more in popular neighborhoods, lower and working class neighborhoods. And they are really dedicated towards having open spaces where the community can come in and see the artwork and interact with artists and even do art themselves. There's also a gallery in downtown Cairo that does that as well. So they're creating new kinds of institutions that are not so exclusive, that have open doors and neighborhood-oriented projects. As for their success, I think only time will tell. I have not been in Egypt to witness some of these public festivals that have occurred, but the reports from my colleagues there indicate that they're extremely well attended, particularly if they have them on the same day that there's a political demonstration. So it's an opportunity to sort of meld the aesthetic and the political in that sense.
For you, as an anthropologist who's been studying this scene for many years, it must have been fascinating for you to witness this whole transition, the revolution and the consequences of it artistically. What have you seen?
It was really, really incredible. I have to say that my main focus during the first 18 days of the revolution when I was in Cairo was to really focus on the visual culture of the revolution, and that's a lot of what my talk will be about, actually, which is about the, the murals, the spontaneous graffiti, what people were writing in the square and around the city about the revolution, as well as the objects that people were creating to sell, things from, calendars with pictures of the martyrs on them to flags with particular designs on them, children's toys that had actually political messages, scarves with revolutionary slogans written on them. So there were a lot of very interesting objects being created and sold in Tahrir for the revolution, and that was very interesting to witness, how people express their revolutionary fervor. What was very interesting was when objects linking the revolution in Egypt with uprisings elsewhere, such as Libya, started to appear. So Libyan flags, for example, or pictures of all of the dictators in the Middle East together on handmade posters criticizing them. I also focused on the other kinds of arts like poetry and music that were coming out of the revolution. And, there's a long tradition of poetry in Egypt, of political poetry in particular. And so that was really amazing to see this sort of outflowing of poetry that wasn't just an expression of the revolution, but was actually a motivator for people to maintain their spirit, to stay in Tahrir, to stay in the city, and to persevere. So art really became a motivator for action and helped people, keep their goals in mind. It wasn't just an expression. So that was very interesting to me, that art had a kind of human agency in that respect.
There's so much talk about the role of social media in the revolutions that have been going on. Is art traveling that way as well, through the internet and in the cybersphere, so to speak?
Oh, absolutely. Facebook has become a very important research tool for those people who are working on the revolution, as well as for all young people in Egypt as well. And so you have the creation of literally hundreds of Facebook sites, for example, dedicated to the arts, different kinds of the arts, urban environment, different media forms, action calls, both in the field of the arts as well as obviously outside of it. So social media has become very, very important. And what's also very interesting to me is the amount of interest in some Western media in the arts of the region again. So there was this, after 9/11, there was a big burst of interest in the arts of the region. I think people wanted to know more about what was going on there and weren't satisfied with just the news of violence. I think we're seeing a bump again where you're starting to see a lot of news articles and radio interviews, for example, coming out that are showing interest in the arts of the region. And so that's really providing a great platform for artists to, you know, to talk about their struggles, their message, their hope for the region. So, and of course, all of that's on the internet and mass media. So it's, I wouldn't, you know, one of the things that's often said about this revolution is that it is a social media revolution. That seems a bit reductionist to me because it wouldn't have happened if there wasn't on-the-ground organizing. But certainly media played a role in galvanizing people and coordinating them, and I think making it happen a lot quicker than it would have happened if we had been in the pre-internet age.
To what extent are women part of this group of artists that you're talking about?
Oh, very much so. And in fact, women are a huge part of the revolution, not just as activists in the square and artists, you know, working in these alternative spaces and public squares, but also working at home. And that's something that we don't think about a lot with the revolution. You need people at home to, you know, to cook and you know, raise children and take care of the day-to-day so the revolution can happen. But for the most part in the artist community, you know, at least 50% of the artists are young women who are out there on the streets with everyone and arguing for their rights, both as women and as Egyptians.
Jessica Winogur is a sociocultural anthropologist. She will be giving a talk called Creativity and Revolution, Egypt at a Crossroads. That's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium on Thursday, the 6th of October at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research, which can be found on the web at sarweb.org. Jessica, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Eleanor Bravo. She's the New Mexico State Organizer for Food and Water Watch. And today, that group is releasing a report called Private Profits, Public Threats. And we're going to talk about that today. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So this basically is about what's going on in New Mexico and the, if I may say so, conflict between so-called business interests and the people.
Exactly. And we are really focused on the impact that has happened since Governor Martinez has taken office, the past 8 months. And we are releasing a independently produced report called Private Profits, Public Threats that outline these environmental impacts.
There's a lot, and maybe too much to go over every single thing in the time that we have, but water and food, which are basically how we stay alive,
yes,
are two major issues that you take on. Let's start with water. What are the threats to clean water in New Mexico, and what's going on legislatively and on the executive side in New Mexico right now?
Well, Food and Water Watch is a consumer organization, and we're devoted to making sure that everyone in New Mexico has access to clean water and safe food. Now, since Governor Martinez took office, she has targeted a number of these regulations that were in place prior to her administration. One in particular is called the Dairy Waste Rule. You may know that the state of New Mexico is the fourth largest producer of dairy products, milk and cheese, in the country. This is big business here.
The
big
fourth
business.
Largest producer of dairy in the country. Okay.
Now, that wasn't so about 10 to 20 years ago, but there was a migration, and New Mexico is part of it.
Now, wait a minute. This migration, it's coming back to me. We did a show a while back about how when dairy rules and pollution rules in particular were tightened up in other states, some of the producers who were operating in a less than ethical way or a less than environmentally sound way, shall we say, actually moved to New Mexico and started operating in their environmentally unsound ways here.
That's true. And we do have a lot of local dairy producers, but the processors of milk and the marketers are all corporate owned and not locally owned. They're corporations from outside the state. And so it's the southern part of the state mostly where we're not talking about cows grazing in beautiful green pastures. We're talking about 10,000 cows crammed into little tiny feedlots. They are loaded with antibiotics and they're causing huge pollution to the groundwater. These big corporations are using what's called lagoons, manure lagoons.
That sounds appetizing.
It's a lovely image. These regulations would have forced these corporations to monitor the groundwater close to these big factory farms. Well, the first day of Governor Martinez's administration, she said, well, look, let's take a look at this. Do we really need it? Well, what has happened is that these lagoons, which would have required liners and monitoring of the groundwater, are just seeping into the groundwater. And we get most of our drinking water from groundwater.
So you have, okay, let's just take a look at this kind of visually in our minds. You have these dairy farms, so to speak, with cows living very, very close together, producing huge amounts of waste,
right?
Urine and feces. This waste goes into these lagoons, so
right.
to speak, these ponds, and they're so concentrated.
That's right.
And they contain antibiotics and all kinds of things.
Right.
And then that goes into the groundwater.
Right. They are nitrogen rich. So it alters the groundwater and alters the environment. And there's already been many reports of illness in these areas.
Now, the dairy rules that were adopted under the Richardson administration were never put into practice, is that correct?
That's right. They had to be published, and that is something that she failed to do. She decided not to publish it. They ultimately were brought under litigation by environmental organizations. So she finally had to publish it, but there was a big compromise.
Well, it was the same thing with the climate change regulations, with
yes.
the carbon cap regulations.
Exactly.
So the rules were published, but there was a compromise?
Yes. So they would have required all of these factory farms to put liners in these lagoons. Now it's only the ones who have had seepage and only new ones. So they're not, the groundwater's not being monitored, so we don't know which ones are having seepage.
Right.
It's a difficult situation, and people are suffering from this.
What is the next step? I mean, Food and Water Watch is bringing this to the attention of the people, but what can New Mexicans do? What can the legislature do? What's next?
What we want is we want Governor Martinez to pay attention to the needs of all New Mexicans, listen to the people of New Mexico, and not only to the people who contributed to her campaign. She has given egregious preference to big business, and the details of all of these things are in the report, and they're all documented. She established what she called a small business-friendly task force. Well, it wasn't friendly, and it was hardly small business. There were lobbyists on that task force who were for BP, for Shell Oil, Chesapeake Energy.
What did the small business task force do?
They were recommending that almost 50 of these environmental controls be, quote-unquote, reviewed and possibly rescinded. And they have only begun. So this is such a time-critical issue. We have an opportunity now to keep our groundwater safe. If we don't pay attention to this now and really, really do something about it, we may be damaging our groundwater for generations to come because you can't clean it up.
No, you can't clean up groundwater once the toxins are in it because of the geology of
exactly.
of the basically underground flow of the water. Now, one of the things that I think is really important to have a public conversation about is the amount of money that is saved when you don't line a manure lagoon and the amount of money it costs to treat childhood leukemia.
Exactly.
Or something like that.
Right. And the people in these areas are lower income and predominantly Hispanic. They're afraid to speak out because they're fearful for their jobs. And these big corporations can certainly earmark part of their resources to taking care of the water that they use. This is not going to put them out of business, in other
right,
words.
Right, right. Now, this is also related to the pit rule, which is actually remarkably similar to the dairy rule. I mean, basically what they're saying is when you have extractive industries like oil and gas, and they do their extraction, and there are pits of toxic waste, they have to line the pits.
It is very similar, and that's another one of those regulations that is targeted by this administration, that we don't really need to have these safeguards. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. The dairy rule and the pit rule are the ones that are in the public eye right now, but there are almost 50 of these regulations that may be on the chopping block. And frankly, it's scary.
We're talking to Eleanor Bravo, New Mexico organizer for Food and Water Watch. Now, another thing that's in your, another little chapter that's in your report, and by the way, the name of the report is Private Profits, Public Threats, put out by Food and Water Watch, is just coming out today, was about the firing of the State Labor Board, and that was kind of a debacle. The State Labor Board was fired, and the governor
yes.
was... What happened?
Well, the Labor Board... It enforces public employees' legal right to join unions and bargain collectively. So Governor Martinez fired three of the members.
The three members.
Exactly. In other
words, that was the whole board.
That was the whole board. So in doing this, she basically stopped the hearing of 43 workplace complaints, including 17 against the governor's staff members.
Good heavens.
So she took care of herself in that respect. Now, the New Mexico Federation of Labor, the AFL-CIO, and other unions sued the governor in New Mexico, and the Supreme Court... New Mexico Supreme Court, and wanting her to reinstate two of the fired board members. Finally, in April, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously against the governor, ordering her to reinstate the two board members.
So basically, I mean, this is a pattern that I think we're seeing, is that the governor or the governor's office is trying to have its way, and it always ends up in court, and pretty much she's losing.
She's basically ignoring the legislature. She's taking her role as sort of a lawmaker, and that is not her role. And she is not paying attention to the rules that are already in place that would benefit the people and not necessarily the companies that have contributed to her.
Now, you have a press conference today, Food and Water Watch. Tell us when and where.
We are going to be at 12:30 p.m. in front of the Roundhouse, and we are going to roll out this report, and we're going to have several speakers there. John Henry, who is the president of the New Mexico Federation of Labor, the AFL-CIO in New Mexico, and Sandy Buffett, who's the executive director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. And then we are going to together deliver a copy of this report to the governor's office. If you would like to read a copy, anyone can go on our website, foodandwaterwatch.org, and we'll send you an electronic copy.
Eleanor Bravo is New Mexico organizer for Food and Water Watch, and again, foodandwaterwatch.org.
That's right.
And you can find out what's happening also in other parts of the country. We had the executive director of Food and Water Watch here talking about hydraulic fracturing.
Fracking
a couple of months ago. And so you guys are doing great work all over the country. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.